Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado, to today's episode. Bronwyn Brophy has over 25 years' experience in the medtech industry, having worked for Thermo Fisher Scientific, Medtronic, Covidien, and Johnson & Johnson in a number of senior roles around the globe, covering businesses including general surgery, women's health, gastroenterology, cardiology, and oncology. She is now the CEO of Vitrolife Group, a world-leading provider of medical devices and genetic services for the reproductive health industry. The company is headquartered in Gothenburg, Sweden, and is listed on the Nasdaq Stockholm. It has over 1,100 employees and revenue of circa $360 million. Vitrolife is the world-leading global provider of medical devices and genetic testing services. Dedicated to the reproductive health market since 1994, they have grown by focusing on product development, groundbreaking research, consistent quality control, and acquisitions of innovative companies in the industry. A global leader in reproductive health focused on supporting customers and patients worldwide to improve treatment outcomes, always with sustainability in mind. Based on science and advanced research capabilities, their aim is to deliver products and services for the entire reproductive health journey, providing consistent performance and guaranteed quality. She has a strong track record in strategy development, accelerating profitable growth, leading M&A, and also driving digital transformations. Bronwyn has led several large-scale R&D programs, building out next-generation platforms. She has worked in multiple regions globally and has experience driving geographic expansion in US and China. Bronwyn was elected to the board of MedTech Europe in 2021 and served as vice chair of the Operations Management Committee. Bronwyn, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Aidan.
A big long CV there, right? So I'm going to start you off with a very easy one because an awful lot of listeners won't know what Vitrolife is. So tell me about Vitrolife.
So Vitrolife is one of the largest players in reproductive health, so IVF. We don't run IVF clinics, but we provide all of the products, tests and services that you would need to provide IVF services to patients. It's a global company. As you mentioned, it's headquartered in Gothenburg, Sweden. But actually, we operate in 94 countries around the world. So, yeah, I would say global leading player in the reproductive health industry.
Now, what struck me when I was doing my little bit of research behind it is, yeah, the company's stated values are integrity, quality, innovation and collaboration, right? Two things that strike me about this and two questions I have from you. One, what struck me about it was that those values came from the bottom up, if memory serves me correctly, not from the CEO that comes in and says, this is what are going to be. So I'm interested to know about that process of the values, you know, kind of percolating up from the bottom, because normally we hear companies and it's always the CEO office dictates the values and are the founder of the company. So that's the first part of it. So tell me about that.
Yeah. So really, that's about a cultural journey that we're going on as a company. So when I came into the role of CEO of Vitrolife 18 months ago, we were looking at the sort of culture, the values, the journey that the company was going on. And what I think the leadership team could see relatively quickly was, depending on which company or business you had come into the company through, you sort of clung to a particular set of values. So I don't like to use the word legacy, okay, because it can create barriers, but the sort of historical Vitrolife quality was the cornerstone of that company. We acquired a genetic services business 3 years ago, and that was very much sort of pioneers and innovators in the whole space of genetic testing. So we had the sort of quality. We also had the innovation piece quite strong. And then both companies were very, very big on teamwork and collaboration. So they were the sort of, I suppose, informal values that were prevalent in the company. The integrity piece then, we're helping couples to have babies. We have to do the right thing always. the position of trust that people place in some anybody operating in this space is huge. So integrity, we started to do a lot of workshops, monkey surveys, skip levels. I mean, this was a process, Aidan, that went on for months. And actually, the four values that kind of bubbled up were the ones that you mentioned. So integrity, innovation, quality and collaboration.
And as the CEO, you know, when you look around the business, how would you say those values are lived in within the company?
Yeah, I can see it everywhere. I can see it. I can feel it. They're not just words on the wall. So just to give an example, so we produce media. Media is like a culture where you place the embryos so that they can develop prior to implantation in the uterus. I'm going to go super technical on you here.
That's fine. No problem.
I'm a wannabe medic behind a CEO, so you'll have to sort of bear with me on this one. So media quality is extremely important. I mean, embryos won't survive if the embryo goes into media that's not of the right quality levels. So if I go down, and I regularly do, so I'll trade in the corporate suit and I'll put on the hairnet and the coat and the overshoes. If I go down into the production site in Gothenburg, you are talking about meticulous dedication to quality, attention to details. You can really, really see it there. Innovation is very, very important in the area of IVF. Mm. Only one in three couples are lucky enough to take home a baby after their IVF journey. So we're constantly striving to sort of bring new tests and products to market. So the innovation piece, since I've come on board, we've tripled our investment in R&D. And again, if you go to any of the sites, we've large R&D teams, we've people looking for the next frontier in genetics, the next frontier in embryo evaluation. Integrity, I spend a lot of time with customers, you know, doing a lot of sort of stakeholder management. And I'm so proud and happy when customers say this to me. If I say I can go to any clinic from, and I have, from Tokyo to Texas, and I will say, you know, if you were to describe Vitrolife in a word, what would you say? And they would say, best quality, best people. So the quality piece comes out. And then collaboration, you know, as in all areas of healthcare, this is a very complicated ecosystem. No one company can do this on their own. No one clinic can do this on their own. There are a lot of interdependencies. So the collaboration is present everywhere. We help customers, they help us, we help suppliers. You sort of have to collaborate in everybody's best interests and to sort of try to move the needle on improving outcomes. So, I see it everywhere. And I'm not one of these people where, you know, let's sort of plaster words on a wall and indoctrinate everybody and make them believe. I think this is something that actually has to come from the ground up. I'm not a big fan of, you know, the management telling 1,200 people around the globe,
this is what we're going
these
to do.
Are the, you know, this is what we're going to be. This is going to be your culture. I don't think you create.
It has to be innate in the company.
I think it has to be innate. And I think as well, you need to inspire people. I mean, you want, you know, they need to feel part of the journey. I have a stake in this. You know, I'm in this for the long haul. So, it's very much been a sort of a groundswell. Mm. And it's really helped our engagement scores, actually. So, I guess more to come. We're only 18 months in, okay? It takes time. But I think so far, it's been going very well with the culture piece.
On that point, and you mentioned you have 90-something sites around the world, but do you think a global company can have one corporate culture?
So we don't have 90 sites.
All right.
We're present in 94 countries.
Okay.
Do I think a global company can have, sorry, your question was?
One corporate culture, when you have so many sites around the world. If you think back to your Johnny John days or your Thermo Fisher days and things like that, there always is this idea, we have a corporate culture. And you're going to go, well, that's fine for head office. But if you're the other side of the world where there's different people, different cultures, all of that type of thing, you know, can you necessarily have one thing, as you said, they're just straight from top to bottom?
I think it's extremely difficult to do. But I think the companies that do it well have the happiest employees and the best results. Mm-hmm. So I have worked for three US multinationals, two out of the three. I'm not going to name which, but two out of the three had extremely strong global corporate cultures. Mm. If I went into an office in New Jersey or if I went into an office in, you know, Sydney, it would feel the same. Yeah. It would look the same. It would feel the same. People would use the same language, act the same, identify the same. And I think it really creates loyalty. I think it creates buy-in. I think it helps people to drive for results. I mean, ultimately, if you're working in healthcare, you're not a mercenary. Mm. You're not there for the paycheck, right? Mm. You, money is important, but you want to make a difference.
Yeah,
you want to make
an impact. There's a vocational element to it.
There's
yeah.
definitely a vocational element.
Yeah.
But that's very, very difficult to do. And not every company that I've worked in has been able to replicate that. It's very difficult to do that at scale if you're, you know, 30, 40, $50 billion company.
Yeah.
So it's tough, very tough. I think the beauty about working in a smaller company is that's easier to do, right? You've 1,100 employees. Everybody's just closer. We, you know, we all kind of know each other. I set myself a goal actually in my first 3 months. I said, I'm going to know everybody's name. Now, I had to go on our Vitronet and get the photos of every single person. Spent a lot of time getting to know all the names. But we know each other. We have a common set of values. A lot of people working in Vitrolife have IVF babies.
Okay.
A lot, actually. We have photos of babies all over the walls. Like, it's a lovely... It's a beautiful place to work, right?
Yeah.
You're helping people have babies. So it's a happy, upbeat place. So I think that sort of feeds into the culture being able to globalize. Right. It sort of facilitates the globalization of the culture.
Well, I suppose ultimately what you're delivering is a commonality to every culture around the world is having babies, right?
Yeah, you know, exactly.
You know, there are certain diseases out there that are only certain, you know, patient populations get them. But, you know, having a baby is a commonality right across the world.
Right across the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, the past few months I've been in Tokyo, in our Tokyo office. A couple of weeks later I was in the Miami office. Do they feel and look exactly the same? No, of course you're going to get
a little localization in it.
Yeah, you'll get the nuances. But I think we have more in common than there being sort of differences.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
One interesting one I love to get your thought on is the you've moved from, if you will, being the CEO of a division of a company to being the CEO of a fully listed company,
yes.
Right? What are the highs and lows of that transition?
Yeah. Well, you've nowhere to hide when you're CEO of a public company. But I would argue you've nowhere to hide when you're a divisional CEO either. So I expected, and I don't say this complacently, I genuinely don't. I half expected the transition to be tougher than it was. I was running a, you know, $850 million business out of Sweden. So I was based in Uppsala. I was reporting into headquarters in Waltham in Massachusetts. I mean, when you work in a company like Thermo Fisher, you get put through your paces. So I owned end-to-end P&L balance sheet. I ran operations. It wasn't the sort of sales and marketing P&L with allocations coming in that I didn't know about. I had to own it.
Yeah.
That's how they sort of drive accountability. That's the business model. You have 24 distinct operating companies. So I was doing everything except the external piece. What sort of helped me with that transition is I have an amazing chairman who was a CEO and who scaled a medtech company called Usher. It's now Embla Medical. So I think he's been sort of a huge help to me. I respect him. I trust him. We have great chats. He kind of doesn't put me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think, as I sort of mentioned to earlier when we were having a cup of tea, I'm a prepper, right? I don't wing anything. Nothing kind of happens by accident, or very few things happen by accident. So I sort of prepped quite well. And then I'm staying in the same space, right? So I'm a medtech lifer. I'm happy to admit that. So same space. I'll tell you an interesting story. I'll give you a bit of skinny for your listeners, which, nice little nugget. So when I got the call about this CEO gig, I was living in Sweden. I'd just been through a really difficult turnaround, running a beautiful business. You know, as I say, an all black P&L, no red numbers, fantastic. Double-digit growth, EBITDA expansion.
Ching, ching, ching.
You know, everything's going great. And I got a call from Korn Ferry in Stockholm about the CEO role. And I said, no, I'm not interested.
Happy.
I have my golden handcuffs. I'm working in the US multinational. I'm running a business that I've just turned around. Everything's great. And they said, we just want to tell you the name of the company. And when they told me the name of the company, I said to the guy in Korn, Whoa, hold on a second. I put him on mute and I Googled it and I said, oh my God, this is like destiny. So I had come across Vitrolife when I was working in Medtronic running women's health.
Okay.
And I made a pitch to the upper management of Medtronic to buy Vitrolife in 2018. So I took the guy off mute and I said, yeah, I'll meet them. So I was sort of all in, yeah. I guess. You know, I was in for, I like the space. I really like the company. I like the culture. I couldn't have really found a better fit, to be honest. So the transition wasn't as tough as I had anticipated.
Now, the one thing you said that is different is, as I call it, the hamster wheel of being a quota company where earnings season comes around four times. You know, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, you know, it's just part of the rhythm.
Yeah.
It's part of the rhythm. So I guess from my sort of US multinational background, I'm very big on governance and structure. And for me, earnings is just, it's part of the structure, right? When is earnings? When do we close the numbers? You know, when do we prepare the deck? What's the follow-up look like? Are we doing it in Handelsbanken or DNB? It's just kind of part of the cycle, part of the corporate calendar. And I think if you prep well, even if you've had a difficult quarter, and I think if you prep and you're transparent, then...
It will be what it'll be.
It'll be what it'll be. Yeah. I don't get stressed about it because I prep, I'm transparent, and I've been building a relationship with our sort of analysts and investors. So, you know, people sort of think earnings, so you see these people four times a year. Like, no, you know, before the quiet period, we'll have a call. I'll meet them at Jefferies. I'll meet them at JP Morgan in San Francisco. So you're sort of constantly building relationships and touching base.
You mentioned earlier that you're a mid-lifer. But have you ever thought about or come close to going off in a completely different direction?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But it happened early.
Okay.
So I actually wanted to study medicine.
Okay.
So I went to Manor House in Rohini. I wanted to study medicine the whole way up. Leaving Cert Cycle, chemistry, biology, fill out the CEO form. It's medicine all the way down. And there was a nun. A lot of people on the north side will know her. Her name was Sister Ethna. Honestly, she must have been in her late 70s when I was there. And she was the career guidance counsellor. And she called me down to her office in January. And she said, Bronwyn, can we have a chat? And I thought, oh, God, this isn't going to go well. And she said, I don't think you should study medicine. I don't think you'll be happy in a white coat. And I took a bit of offence to this. I thought I was cock of the walk. I said, why, sister? Do you not think I'm going to get the points? And she said, I do think you're going to get the points. And I think you're going to be miserable. She said, Bronwyn, you were made for the world of business. We've had a chat about this in the staff room. And she used an old French word. She said, you're a merchant. You're a marchand. She said, I watched you at the school bank. I've watched you in commerce. I've watched you in economics. You're meant to be a businesswoman. So she sowed a seed of doubt. And lo and behold, I went home and I changed the famous or infamous CEO form. And I put down International Marketing and Languages in DCU, which was the course at the time. And being cool was quite important to me as well, right? So I wanted to be clever, but I also wanted to be cool. So Marketing and Languages was the course. Everybody wanted to do it. EU was big at the time. So I was like, yeah, that looks good. I like languages. So when I changed the CEO form, International Marketing and Languages 1, Medicine 2, 3, 4, 5. So lo and behold, I got International Marketing and Languages. I remember sitting in DCU on my first day with my little piece of, do you remember the computer printout paper? It was kind of a greeny colour.
Yeah.
And I had it in my hand and I remember sitting there going, what am I doing here? Like, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm supposed to be in Trinity or UCD doing medicine. And my first couple of years of college were really hard. I kind of had this dilemma. Am I supposed to be here? Am I supposed to be doing medicine? And should I throw in the towel? I didn't because I was too proud. And I was the first person, actually, I was the first of all the grandchildren on my dad's side. And my dad's one of eight to go to college. So there was no way I was kind of letting anyone down. I was firstborn child as well. So I said, no, I'm going to have to like stick this out. So I finished in DCU and I went for an interview in Johnson & Johnson out in Tala. And they had two graduate programs, one for consumer health, one for consumer products, and one for medical devices. And I wanted the consumer one because it had Rock and Aveeno and, you know, I had visions of rocking into the place. And I'm going to be the Rock girl and I'm going to be the brand manager of this. And I think I started on like €13,000 or something. And I had a little Clio going across the M50. Anyway, I went in and they said, no, you're working on the medical device side. And I was disgusted. I was like,
nobody ever sees
it.
Them.
I got a 2-1. They're going to send me over there to work with like hips and knees, the cheek of them. And I went over and about, no joke, I would say within a month, I went, this is where I'm supposed to be. Mm-hmm. I am actually supposed to be working on the business side of a healthcare company. It was like the stars aligned. So I kind of coped. There were a couple of times when the medicine came out in UL when I was about 31, 32. But at that stage, you know, I was sucked in. Yeah. I was sucked in. So am I a failed medic or I don't know. I guess I sort of, I'm in the perfect place, I think. Yeah.
So that was the sliding door moment, was it?
That was the sliding, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I say a lot of people kind of come to me and say, will you chat to my leaving cert son or daughter? Will you have a chat with her and sort of career advisor? And I always say, listen, no problem. My caveat is going to be, I'm going to say to the kid, do what makes you happy. I'm not going to tell them to, you know, go for, you know, medicine in Trinity or pharmacy. And I'm going to say to the child, what are you really passionate about? What do you love? Because we tend to be best at what we love. And about 50% of them will say, no, your grandma.
Yeah, no. I prefer to have a miserable doctor once they're a doctor.
I prefer to have a rich, miserable doctor than a happy artist, you know?
Another thing you mentioned there in terms of building up the rapport with the analysts and the shareholders and things like that, how important do you think it is that their capital investors are aligned with you and your goals for the company?
Oh, very important. Yeah. So when I came on board, you know, fantastic company, great legacy. My sort of assessment was brilliant portfolio, amazing talent. What's the play? Like, I'm a strategist. Mm-hmm. If you slice me and dice me, I'm a strategist. Where are we going? How are we going to get there? And I couldn't really see the play. Mm-hmm. So we brought in a bit of help. We got in a bit of help from BCG. I rate BCG, Boston Consulting, very highly. We got them to work with us on the strategy. And some of the first, I mean, obviously we went to the employees, we went to customers, we spoke with patients, and of course we spoke with our key investors. Mm. And we presented and we kind of, you know, we was iterative and we said, you know, this is the play we think we should make in order to grow the company profitably, sustainably, and ultimately become the leading player in reproductive health. And they aligned, they liked it. So we've very much gone down the route of a technology trade-up, a platform play. We sort of want to be the, we don't want to be a company just bringing out products and services. Yeah. That's not going to be how you ultimately win here. We want to bring out products and services, but connect
to a platform,
all of those
solutions.
Yeah, essentially integrate the patient pathway for IVF. So they really liked that. I'm blessed to have a lot of long-term Scandinavian shareholders, and you need patients to do a platform play. I mean, if you're going to integrate an IVF journey, that's not going to be something you do in 24 months. So I think onboarding them, listening to their feedback, kind of got the buy-in early, Aidan, and it's really, really helped. So then we did a capital markets day and presented that strategy in Stockholm. And I mean, the great thing is you get alignment. You can bring everyone on the journey. The challenging part is once you sort of state that strategic direction, you have to be able to demonstrate that you're making
progress. Nailed your colours to the wall.
We've nailed the colours. So now it's all about executing. What do the metrics say? Are we really doing what we say we're doing? And I think that's, you know, where you need to sort of keep building the relationships with the key shareholders, investors and analysts. Yeah.
Yeah. And similarly, I suppose you mentioned that your chairman has been a great help for you in terms of moving into the body. So how do you manage your board and investors maybe when things aren't going so well?
Yeah. So again, our board, we have a fantastic board, really well balanced. So we have a mix of former CFO, former CEO. We have one of our second biggest shareholder, actually. So they have somebody on the board. So I would say a really well balanced board, both in terms of competence, background. And you know what? For me, the best boards are a great balance between providing advice and support, but letting me run the show. Okay, so they don't sort of overreach. Have we had 5-6 perfect quarters? No. The way I sort of manage the board is I'm extremely transparent. I just come in. This is the situation. This is what's going really, really well. This is what we have to improve. You know, I'm very much about show them the data. Don't just go in spinning a yarn. Like I like to show data with metrics. I think the other thing that I do, maybe back to my West Point days in my US multinationals, you know, I will prepare a deck for the board. I take them through the same deck every single quarter so that they can track.
See continuity.
We have a corporate dashboard, balance scorecard, metrics. Here's how we're doing on growth. Here's how we're doing on EBITDA. Here's what the R&D pipeline looks like. Here's where the turnover is at. So I'm sort of building, well, I hope I'm building trust. I'm sort of constantly building that trust and building bridges with them as a board, but also individually. I think I have had to learn, Aidan, you know, not to pull them in too much. So they're very cognizant of kind of letting me be the
CEO. Split between executive and non-executive roles.
Yeah, exactly. And it is a balance and it's a fine balance. And one of the individuals on the board, he's very commercial, which I really like. You know, you need to make your numbers. And sometimes I'll sort of send him the odd email and go, Lars, what do you think of this one? And he's fine. He'll send me back a 2-line email. Yeah, you're on the right track. Or not so sure about that one, Bronwyn. Maybe run it by. So I think you manage them as a collective. And then there's a little bit of one-to-one management as well.
Gary McGann, I always remember him said it to me when we interviewed him. He said, your board of directors are the cheapest set of management consultants you'll ever have.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And he says, but you know, you're foolish if you don't actually use them. And that is true. In terms of the West Point thing and the numbers and being present with that, does that mean you obsess about the small things?
No, not really. I don't think, I think it would be very difficult to be successful in a CEO role if you obsess about the small things. That doesn't mean sometimes small things don't annoy me. Right. So there is a bit of a perfectionist in me. I think I'm more about the important versus the non-important as opposed to the small versus the big. What is really, really going to move the needle? No, I don't. I would say I don't. But little small things, if they're not right and they build up, I will get on it. So I think the bigger hang up for me is, if my husband was here, he would say, oh, no, that's definitely her bigger hang up. Professionalism is extremely important to me. So if you're going to do something, do it right. And that can be
anything
from baking a cake to running a $360 million company. Like, do it properly, give it your best shot. It doesn't have to be perfect, but give it your best shot and do it professionally. I'd probably get more hung up about that, I would say.
The going back to something about innovation, right? Do you think there's always this risk as you get bigger, the level of innovation in a company falls because of the quantum? So you're on this journey, and as you said, you're moving to the platform. So, you know, What will you be looking at to make sure that that level of innovation doesn't fall? And it's not just about throwing money at something. I think it's different to that.
Yeah. So we are in a space, an area of healthcare that is in dire need of innovation. So IVF today is very labour intensive, very manual. You go into any clinic around the world and you are literally going to see people carrying a Petri dish to an incubator. Quite different, I would even say more labour intensive than most other areas of healthcare. So, and we're only scratching the surface in terms of the number of patients that actually get to go on that IVF journey. So it really needs help in scaling. The only way that we can scale is to automate, digitalise and bring innovation. And that's just the way it is. I mean, if you look at the sort of what I call the mega trends, the macro trends in the IVF space, they can't be solved without innovation. Yeah. They just can't. Clinics are consolidating. Demand is increasing. It's labour intensive. Outcomes are 1 in 3. You have a 1 in 3 chance of taking home a baby. Like, you've better chance of having a successful triple bypass. I kid you not. So for me, innovation in-house, organic, very, very important, supplemented with key strategic M&A. I think in the past, Vitrolife has been extremely successful at the M&A part. I mean, we have. It's a fun, you know, the company, the story is incredible. It's one of the darlings of the Nasdaq Stockholm. I think possibly where we dropped the ball a little bit was on the innovation piece. Side. So we've really upped the ante there. I mean, you know, and we have an innovation roadmap. Again, these are sort of, I think, really good best practices that I've been able to take from countries like, or companies, excuse me, like Medtronic, really, really good at innovation. So we have an innovation roadmap with a mixture of what's the sort of iterative innovation we're going to bring, what's the more transformative, are we looking at any blue sky, what can ultimately, you know, move the needle. Is it going to be genetics? Is it going to be AI? We're doing a lot of work at the moment on marrying AI and genetics in order to be able to select the embryo with the highest chance of success. And we're the only company that can technologically do that. So I'm not a fan, and I don't like to see it. I'm not a fan of when you get big, you spend less on innovation. As far as I'm concerned, that's the fastest route to failure. You need to consistently invest in innovation if you are working in healthcare, and nowhere more so than where we're operating as a company.
What's the hardest part of the job as a CEO?
This is really cliche, but it's also really true. The CEO role is a lonely old seat. Like, people used to say that to me. Oh, you know, it's different being a divisional CEO because you have 23 other divisional CEOs. And we would have picked up the phone to each other. You know, you're going to find it a bit lonely. I mean, I'm sure the minute you met me, you instantly recognised a people person. I mean, that's what I am. It can be quite lonely. And I was saying to my executive management team there before the Christmas, when the information arrives on the CEO desk, it's either really, really sanitized, so it all looks so beautiful that it can't be true, or it's something absolutely horrendous that nobody else wants to solve. So you are sitting in that sort of lonely seat with either a problem that appears way too perfect to be real, or how are we actually going to solve this one? And everybody's looking for me to provide the answers. So I do think it's a lonely station. And I think keeping a sort of a council of advisors and mentors is really, really important. Because, it can be a lonely place. And the interesting thing is, it can be a lonely place in the good times and the tougher times, even in the really, really good times. You know, you have a great quarter, or after Capital Markets Day, you know, our share price shot up, everything's fantastic. You can have the lonely moment in the good time too. Yeah. So, you know, if you're a person who sort of struggles with introspection or reflection or a bit of loneliness, you're going to have to get used to that and learn to cope with it. Yeah.
There's an idea out there, and I think it's very true, having met an awful lot of CEOs over the years, but as a CEO, you don't necessarily get better at the job, but you do get quicker at making the important decisions.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think that's true. Well, I think a bit of both, actually, right. Aidan. Okay. I think you start to build that CEO muscle. Hmm. And when you build that sort of bit of muscle, you grow in confidence. And I guess the growing confidence helps you to take the tougher decisions. But you're always going to get a curved ball. Hmm. I mean, that's just the reality, right? I in the time, I started in August. I started in the August. My first year end, I had to face an impairment. I'm like, it's my first year end as CEO. We're doing an impairment. I mean, I knew how to do impairments, right? Gordon's formula. I look, obviously, again, back to the US multinational drilling. I could do it for you on a spreadsheet, but managing an impairment and how you tell the story and the why and the wherefore. You're building the muscle, you're hopefully getting better, you feel you're growing in confidence. Every single quarter, every single year end, you get a curved ball. Yeah. You just do. There's no such thing as the perfect quarter or the perfect year. So I think it's a bit of both, actually.
Switching tacks in terms of I suppose, your management company, your management committee and things like that, and as you've gone through the various different ranks, where are the different companies? Where are you on the hiring talent or develop from within?
Yeah. Look, I always like to give the homegrown talent the shot at the title. Yeah. I always do. Come on, you have to take care of your own. But inevitably, you're going to have to do a combination of both. That's just the way it is. And if I take this particular role, like we didn't have a vice president general manager of the US. Right. You can't be a global company
In healthcare and not have.
We had leadership there, but we didn't have. Sorry, actually, we recruited a senior vice president and I put her directly onto the executive management team of the company. And I knew exactly who I was going for. Mm. I handpicked her. I mean, I'm a long time in this industry. I know the good ones. Mm-hmm. I know the ones who think they're good. I know the ones who are good for a couple of quarters. And I know the ones who are going to deliver sustainable, profitable growth. And I picked the target and I went, that is going to be the person for us. Mm. So there are definitely some hand-picked people who've come on board. I think it's good to do, interviewing as well externally. You get to sort of see the talent out there. Competitors are always going to come in and interview. So I think overall a mix, but I always like to try, if possible. Like, why am I sitting here in front of you today, Aidan? Because people took chances on me. Mm. I haven't gone into one role in my career that I was ready for. Like, I haven't, right? Everything was a stretch. So I'm always give him a shot. If he doesn't make it, and I'd be very, my brand is very much around authenticity and being direct and being transparent. And I will say to people, this is a stretch. I'm going to put you in there. If it doesn't work out, it's fine. We'll find something else. But I'm going to be honest with you if it's not working. And most of them have panned out. I have had one where it didn't pan out. And actually, he came to me and thanked me. No, I wasn't ready, Brahman. Can I apply again in 12 months' time? You need to be taking a chance on people. Obviously, coach them, develop them, prep them as much as you can to be ready for the role. Mm-hmm. But I'm a real firm believer in taking a chance on people. I love an underdog. I got that from my mum. So a bit of both.
You raised something in that last question. So in terms of recruiting people and things like that, but how important then are personal networks, in terms your own personal networks, as you look through the industry and in terms of contacts, in terms of future hires, in terms of whatever?
Great question. Actually, I asked that very question to my chairman a couple of months before Christmas. I said to him, Yon, am I kind of over hiring from outside? Because I'd brought in maybe two or three in a row, even though I'm telling you I like to do the homegrown. There were a couple of really sort of key specialist areas where I thought we needed external talent, regulatory affairs being one of them. And I said to him, Yon, am I bringing in too many industry specialists? And he said, no, He said, part of the reason why we hired you is because of your network. You're known for that network. You know the right people in the right places. So I think so long as you don't over-pull on that network, then it can work. And I do. I leverage it. It may not make me popular with my former employers because I've very strategically plucked the best of the best.
Yeah.
But then you have to sort of think about the cultural fit, right?
Yeah.
Is it Johnson & Johnson, Thermo Fisher, Medtronic, are they going to fit in with the more Scandinavian type consensus? Mm. So I think you have to sort of get that balance. But the network is huge. Mm. In this industry, I mean, healthcare, we all know each other.
Yeah.
You know, and on the female side, unfortunately, sadly, there are very... So everybody wants females for executive management, for boards and for CEOs. And on the, there are only, I don't know, I can count them on my two hands. There are only 8 or 9 of us. So if I sort of get a call from somebody else, which I regularly do, there's not a week that goes by than Korn Ferry, Russell Reynolds, Egon don't phone me and say, Bronwyn, do you know any CEOs, female, for X?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I can give you the same
ones I gave
names.
You the last
yeah.
I gave you last
yeah,
week.
Exactly. So the network is really, really important.
Yeah.
And actually we all help each other quite a bit, which is nice. There's a really good sense of camaraderie in medtech.
But does that go back to the vocational element?
It does, absolutely. Because there are less mercenaries in here.
Yeah.
People come in here because they want to have an impact, a positive impact in healthcare, and then they want to have a successful career, right? It's both.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all quite like-minded.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I remember when I was leaving Johnson & Johnson in 2012, and I was bawling my eyes out the day I left, and the group company chairman of Europe at the time was this French guy, and he was like, but Bronwyn, I don't understand. Why are you leaving? I mean, you're crying. You shouldn't be leaving. And I said to him, Guy, I walk like a Johnson & Johnson person. I talk like a J&J person. I wear navy suits, white shirts. And I was on the inside cover of the annual report. Like, I'm becoming a clone. That's just what happens, right?
Yeah.
You buy in so much to the sort of greater good of healthcare.
Mm.
And I mean, I'm godmother to 4 people who I know through the children of four people who I worked with.
Yeah.
I'm godmother. And so we're you know, sort of quite a close-knit community.
Mm.
As I like to say, we give each other the leg up and kind of help quite a bit, which is nice.
Yeah. Now, living in Sweden. Talk to me about living in Sweden.
Or as my brother Kieran calls us, the Jürgen Fjörgens. He said, the Jürgen Fjörgens are coming home for Christmas. I absolutely love it.
Right.
So we moved to Sweden as a family. 18 months ago. So I had been living and working in Uppsala, but I was commuting back to Clontarf. But we all moved. We decided, okay, I don't need to be getting on planes every Friday and doing a CEO of a public company gig. So everyone has to move. So we all moved to Gothenburg. My husband, the 2 kids and the dog. And it was a tough sell.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, my son, when we told the kids we were moving, my son was very logical about it. He had a great line. He said, Mum and Dad, he's 15, is the decision taken? And we said, yeah. And he said, well, there isn't really a lot for me to say then, is there? No, I love it. We call him the king of logic. We were like, no, son, and there's not a lot to say. My daughter had a meltdown. You're taking me out of Clontarf. You're taking me out of GAA, Belgrove, my school. She's a little parish person,
right.
So she had a total meltdown. It was Gone with the Wind, Scarlett O'Hara sort of level meltdown. So I felt really guilty. Like, I'm, you know, why am I doing this? And, you know, my husband moving as well. So we moved. And honestly, it's been fantastic for us as a family. You know, Sweden... I don't want to come across like one of these sort of preachy expats because I run a mile from them myself. But this is a country where everything works. It's like Switzerland. So
I have a brother in Switzerland.
Yeah, I mean, it's immaculate. And it's not immaculate because there are people going around cleaning the streets. Nobody throws litter on the streets. So everything runs on time. The buses, you could eat your dinner on the bus. Mm. Everything is spotlessly clean. Everything runs on time. I was in the country 2 weeks, Aidan, and I get everything's digitalized. Mm. So you have an app on your phone. You've one app that pretty much does everything. I was in the country 2 weeks. I get my app beeps, invitation to smear test. I go and do my smear test. I get the results online within 10 days. 2 weeks after that, invitation for a mammogram. Mm. You know, again, phone beeps 3 weeks later. All clear, yeah. You know, see, yeah. It just everything works.
Functions.
It's a functioning, really well functioning society. And then I get the line, oh, but you pay really high taxes. Yeah, no, I don't. Mm. I actually, you know, if you actually look at the effective tax rate, it's not so dissimilar to here. Yeah. And for that, you are getting incredible level of service. Free childcare. People talk about free childcare. It is literally your children go to school. You tick a box on a form. Do you want them to stay for aftercare? No questions asked. Mm. It's a slower pace of life. Very, very healthy. So I spent a lot of time working in general surgery and worked with colleagues who focused on obesity. Very few obese people in Sweden. They eat healthy. They exercise a lot. So I mean, I love it. Mm. It's not the end.
It's not Timbuktu either. It's not as if you're not on a plane back in 2 hours or 2.5 hours, you know?
No, it's not. Now, the people are, they're more reserved. Mm. Definitely, they're more reserved. The Swedes are actually a little bit shy. I think they were shocked. You know, the four O'Connors and the crazy cockapoo arrive and we go down the road waving at everybody. Hi, we've just arrived from Ireland. And they're sort of waving their hands in their pockets. They're like, God, absolutely crazy Irish. But there's a shyness to the Swedes. So they are a bit reserved, but there's also a shyness to them. They're very sort of wholesome. People will bake bread and leave it at your door. Or, sorry now, I sound like Little House on the Prairie, but, you know, they leave apples out in autumn time and they'll write Varsha good. You know, you're welcome. Yeah. Help yourself. But what do we miss about Ireland? I mean, the people, you know, and I don't want to give the sort of, oh, we miss the crack. Because when people say that in Australia and America, I'm like, oh, don't give me the whole we miss the crack. Irish people are really warm and really welcoming. I was at an event in Galway in early December and my chief of staff was in the car with me. He was born in Serbia, but grew up in Sweden. And this lovely man is driving us back to Dublin Airport from Galway. We get into the car. How are you doing, Brahman? Would you like a drink of water? Yes, please. Would you like a mint? No, I'm Grant. My name's John and I'm from Carrigaholt. And he's telling me everything. And my son is in Dubai and my other son. Just this really lovely man. Anyway, he put on a bit of jazz music and he said, do you like jazz, Brahman? I said, I actually hate jazz, but I listen to anything else. And Dan is sitting beside me and he said, are all Irish people like this? And I said, like what? And he said, Brahman, in the past 15 minutes, he's offered us water, mint and whatever we want on the radio. And I said, yeah, they actually are. Like we are really warm and we are really kind, actually. And that's what you miss. You miss the friends and the family. But there's not a whole lot else that I'd swap, to be honest. I think if I could take the Irish people and plant
them in Sweden,
that would be utopia. Yeah.
A few rapid fire ones here now. Do you hate losing or love winning?
Oh, God, I hate losing. I'm a really bad loser. I am absolutely terrified of losing. Mm. So that makes me an extremely competitive person. And a very ungracious loser.
Then has fear of failure been a big driving force for you?
Yeah, huge. Yeah.
All the way through your career?
All the way through. Yeah, very much so. Mm. Yeah, I would. Do you know what it is? I think it started in my childhood. To be honest with you, Aidan, that sort of came with me all the way through. So it hasn't been just in my career. It was in school. It was in college. I think part of it comes from the fact that I am a firstborn. I have two brothers. I didn't have a lot of competition, but I probably thought I had. Always wanting to be the sort of the good child and not let my parents down and not fail. It's very ingrained in me. Yeah.
How do you deal with setbacks?
I don't really dwell on things. Right. I'm a bit of a dust myself off. Like, you know, I'll take my medicine. So if I lose or, you know, setback, I sort of take my medicine and I move on. I'm not a sulker. I don't dwell on things. I don't hold grudges. I just sort of deal with it and move on. I'd be a good woman for sort of draw a line in the sand. Just let it go, Bronwyn. I don't tend to dwell on setbacks. The other thing about me is I'm the eternal optimist. I'm an extremely optimistic person. So, you know, if I have a bad day at the office, tomorrow will be a good day. Yeah. I tend to see I'm very much a sort of a glass half full type of person. So that kind of helps me with moving forward.
I know you're not in the job long, but how do you feel about what you've done already in the company?
Yeah.
And if we were to meet in 3 years' time, what would you hope you'd have achieved by then within the company?
Yeah, so the way I see it is I'm sort of 1 year into the 5-year journey of those sort of corporate objectives that we've set. And it is a 5-year journey. So when investors or analysts get excited, and they started to get excited a little bit early, I had to sort of pour a little bit of water on the fire and say, no, this is going to be a long-term journey. I really, really believe this, Aidan. It is a marathon, not a sprint. So look at the sort of longer term metrics. So the way I see it is strategy is very well set up. We're on the cultural journey. We've started our US scale up. So the key talent's on board. We've started our US scale up. US scale ups are complex, costly, and they take time. And you have to have patience for them. But we're starting to get some nice traction particularly in the last quarter or two. So I would say we're on track in terms of sort of metrics for where we should be. If you were to meet me in 3 years' time, well, you know, absolutely double-digit growth in the US. We'll get there hopefully before 3 years. Our plan is to return the company to double-digit growth. I don't want to do that by sacrificing EBITDA. So we've been sort of very, very clear back to the earlier point around setting our strategic intent. In terms of our platform development, the whole R&D piece, we are planning to launch phase one of the platform in 24 months' time. We're ahead at the moment. We will get setbacks. You always get setbacks in R&D. So we will get setbacks. So I'd say we'll probably be there or thereabouts, you know, sort of 2-3 years' time. So for me, it's very much steady as she goes. You know, don't back away from the difficult things. Don't deliver the quarters at the sacrifice of the long term. So balancing the sort of short and long term. But I do remain confident that we're progressing well on that 5-year plan. Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You've had a few different jobs along the way and different organisations. So how did you know when it was the right time to either leave a role or move on to the next stage in your career?
Gosh, that's a great question. And I don't have a good answer for you, but something... It always seemed to line up for me. Maybe that's a bit of the luck of the Irish. I never had to go looking for a job. I've been blessed in that sense. I mean, the thing is, in the US multinationals, it's a drill school.
Yeah.
Like, you're 36 months in a row and then you're moved.
On.
If you're hitting the metrics, that's it.
Yeah.
And I was impeccably managed and groomed and, you know, I was sent to Harvard, I was sent to Smith College, I went to MIT. So I got the best of the best development. That's what happens when you work in those multinationals. And they sort of prepared me all the way along. So every sort of 36 months, they were stretching me. And they were right, because
bored Bronwyn is not good. I become destructive when I'm bored. You have to keep intellectually challenging me. And I think that was spotted pretty early on, you know, keep stretching her. So I would say the sort of sweet spot for me. Now, it's different when you get to the CEO level because you're going to put in, it's a longer game, right? Yeah. It's just much longer to sort of have that impact. But for me, in most of the roles, they were sort of a three-year stint. Mm. And then I got moved on and either moved to a different country or a different region. And I loved that. I loved the variety of that. I like to be challenged. Mm. I'm not one who can just sort of sit on the stable bus. I like to be either doing a turnaround, or I think what's more sort of become my thing is I tend to do best in accelerate growth roles. And that was what I was becoming known as in the industry. So those accelerate growth roles started to come my way because I was known for it. And then with this role, I just think this was meant to be. I think it was this is my dream job. Mm. I mean, I'm CEO of an IVF company in a space that I love. It's a public company, so I have that extra bit of challenge. We've one big competitor. I love having a big gorilla to go after. So we have one big US competitor. So that sort of brings out the whole competitive piece, galvanizing the team around that. So in many ways, this is the sort of perfect role for me. A good balance between using the sort of tools and my sort of leadership repertoire, but also stretching me and putting me through my paces.
Very good. Now, we've come to the black book time.
Oh, gosh, here we go.
We've come to the black book time. And as is always the way, I have no idea what's going to be on this page when I open it up. Oh, right. This will be interesting. Who has been the biggest inspiration in getting you to where you are today and why?
Oh. Can I pick two people?
Yeah, can.
Because if I pick one and I don't pick the other, there'd be skin and hair flying.
Yeah, you can pick two.
I'd have to say my parents.
Right.
So my mum and dad both came from very humble backgrounds. My dad was one of eight. He grew up in Dunnycarney. He would say we had to lace our toes together and paint our feet black because we were so poor. We didn't have
He's
shoes.
A Brendan Grace fan.
You know, he does massive Brendan Grace. It wasn't quite that, but the family had to, the family emigrated to Australia in the 1968-1969. Because it was just so tough in Dublin. My mum's family were wealthier because they had six kids and lived in Raheny. So they were the sort of wealthy ones. So both of my parents left school in their teens. They had incredible work ethic. Mm. Unbelievable. So my dad started delivering milk around Clontarf when he was 12 and 13. And when I bought the house in Clontarf, he said, we used to deliver to those posh houses in Clontarf. And then my mum, you know, they were just really, really hardworking. They were very forward thinking. So, my mum was sending me to Spain to spend the summers there when I was 12 and 13 years of age to learn an additional language. So my mum was a tiger mom. Mm. She was like the Asians. You have to play a sport, you have to play a musical instrument, and you need to speak an international language. And they sacrificed everything for me. They really, really did. You know, there was a school trip to Russia. My parents couldn't really afford the school trip. You know, my mum did two jobs to make sure I went on that sort of school trip. And so I think they instilled the sort of the hard work, the drive. And I think most importantly, the sort of, you know, you're as good as everyone else, but no better. And that's kind of my life motto, my CEO motto, my mom motto, my wife motto. So I'd have to say it was my mum and dad. Yeah.
Very
They'd be
good.
Delighted.
We'll get that sent
They're
to them.
They're finally getting thanks for something.
For all the heartache you gave them through the years.
Exactly.
Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Bronwyn Brophy. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.